Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, why white people struggle to talk about race. Now, some of you heard that sentence and thought, not another show about how all white people are racist. I've heard enough of that. That is not this show. Some of you thought, yeah, let's nail all those Trump voters for the racists that they are. That's also not this show. This show is a candid, constructive discussion about how to accept a truth that we all carry racialized assumptions and beliefs and meet those assumptions head on. And yeah, it's probably going to be a little uncomfortable. Robin DiAngelo writes in a note at the beginning of her new book, rather than retreat in the face of that discomfort, we can practice building our stamina for the critical examination of white identity. As Robin joins us, I think we'd like to hear from you. If you question or you're genuinely curious about the premise of the show, we'd like to hear your cogent thoughts and argument. I think Robin will have some answers for you. If you're interested in how to meet that discomfort about race head on, we'd like to hear your thoughts. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie, KERRIMPR. Robin DiAngelo is a trainer on race and social justice. She's also lectured and written widely about race. Her new book is titled White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. And she's with us today from Seattle. And Robin, welcome to the show. It's really a pleasure to have you here for the hour.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Let's establish this right off the top. You're white, and you say
that
gives you a certain kind of insider status on the topic. How so?
Well, in some ways, being white would make it harder, or has made it much harder for me to understand the impact of race on my life. But, of course, as an insider to white identity, with some deep reflection and years and years and years of day in and day out talking to primarily other white people, along with some deep mentorship from people of color, I know the white experience in a way that people of color can't, although I feel the need to say that people of color in many ways understand white identity in ways that I never will.
Oh, okay. Well, tell me what you mean by that.
Well, they experience our consciousness, right? The way we've been socialized, they have that perspective. Generally, people of color and black people in particular have thought deeply about race from very, very early age. And generally, white people have not thought deeply about race. So you have people interacting with us who have a much more critical consciousness than we do. And they're going to recognize, it's like being a fish in water, right? They're going to recognize aspects of that water that I can't because, again, I'm in it.
I was going to say, do you think the reason that white people, I'm white as well, you're white, mm-hmm. have not had to think about race very much is what you've just said? The world feels comfortable. We feel secure in our place in that world. It's just not something that occurs every day to feel at odds with our environment.
Yeah, I mean, day in and day out, I move through a world in which I am racially comfortable. It's rare for me to be outside of my racial comfort zone. And generally, that is a situation that I can choose. And in both implicit and explicit ways all my life, I've been warned not to choose to be outside of my racial comfort zone.
You heard me suggest at the beginning of the show that just as you write in the book, that there will be some people who say, well, they're not talking to me. I didn't vote for Trump. I've got lots of black friends. I'm not one of those people that Robin DiAngelo has to talk to about this. What's the answer back to that?
Well, white progressives, you're describing a white progressive, they're my specialty because I am a white progressive. And that is a particular consciousness that I think can actually be even more difficult and more challenging for people of color.
Why?
In fact, I think we create the daily climate that is often experienced as hostile and unsupportive, but we're not only oblivious to how we do that, but tend to be pretty defensive about gaining any information about how we do that because we see ourselves as not the problem. So white progressives tend to put our energy on when the topic comes up, establishing our credentials as not racist and not put any of our energy on what we really need to be doing for the rest of our lives in a society that is deeply separate and unequal by race. So what we need to be doing is engaging in ongoing critical self-reflection and knowledge, relationship building, mistake making, ongoing education, risk-taking, strategic, intentional action, not just, hey, I'm good to go because I'm a nice person. So we can be the most resistant.
You know, you use a phrase when you're talking about the white progressive approach to this. I think you say something about consider yourself a lifelong learner on race. Now, that's a frame that I think we accept in a lot of different places in our lives, right? Let's open our minds to the idea that we still have a lot to learn. As people who might think we come with the best intentions to this, there's still a lot to learn, and you'll learn through your life. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I've never met a white person who didn't have an opinion on racism, right? I mean, we have opinions, and they tend to be very emotional and very charged. I don't believe you can grow up in this society and not developed opinions on racism, but that does not make them informed. And there's a very interesting lack of humility that happens when the topic is race. You know, I'll be on an airplane talking to a stranger. They'll ask me what I do. I literally do have a PhD in this topic. And rather than ask me my thoughts, the average white person will proceed to tell me theirs in the most simplistic way, right? Just, oh, yeah, people just need to, and then fill in the blank. It doesn't really matter what comes next. And now, you know, topic closed. And I'm always just kind of, wow, I mean, why did I knock myself out for 20 years? I should have just asked you. And it's so simple, and I've never even heard that before. Yeah, it's so emotional for us that we get very certain and very arrogant. But, you know, nothing in dominant culture gives us the information we need to have an informed opinion. I mean, you have to work at it, right? You can get through graduate school in this country without ever discussing racism. You can be seen as qualified to lead a major or minor institution to manage people without any ability to engage with complexity or nuance in the topic of race.
So this is such a good point because I feel like we are a people who like to think of ourselves, especially the audience that's tuned in today. We're curious people. We're interested in learning. If you said to somebody, hey, it's a great tenet to be a lifelong learner about science, right? Or some other discipline.
Yep.
But there's some kind of barrier to that idea of, I don't know it all. I do still have stuff to learn about race.
Well, I would be pleasantly surprised if we don't get a caller or two or three who calls in to establish the opinions that they already hold, right? They're going to tell us, they're going to tell me the answer to racism. Yes, something very interesting happens. Now, it's a combination, and this is what I talk about in the book, of not just being insulated racially and being comfortable, so not having to build the capacity for the discomfort of a racial conversation in this country, but also entitled to feel comfortable, some superiority. I do not believe you can be raised as a white person in this culture and not internalize a deep sense of racial superiority. The messages are relentless. They circulate around us 24/7. And one person telling me to treat everyone the same is not enough to override those messages.
Jamie says on Twitter, being part of the dominant culture, white people don't often experience another culture, even within the United States, in some meaningful way. As in relationship with non-whites, not merely passing through as a tourist. And to the phones, yeah. To Ellen in Champlin. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, not a problem. No, I wanted to say, I think this is a very important topic, and I'm really glad we're discussing it. And I'm not going to give you my opinion.
You're a learner, yeah. Ellen.
Yeah, I was trying to preempt it.
But one thing that I think is very interesting is, as I'm a millennial. I'm 31 years old right now. And I very much grew up in school. Well, I grew up in a majority white school. We had a lot of Hispanics, but it was majority white, not a lot of black people there. But I grew up with the world view of a world with everyone holding hands around of all different colors. And I didn't know that there was, like, inequalities between races. I didn't get it until, you know, college. And then I'm like, wait, what? And that was really hard for me to realize. Kind of like that basically I was just ignorant of it. And it was sad, and it was hard for me to realize that. And then realize that, wait, I have these ideas that, like you were saying, that a lot of the majority race are kind of blind to at times. Mm-hmm. And so I just think it's an important topic. So thank you for discussing
Thank you. Yeah, and I have a couple thoughts on that segregation, which you're describing. You know, most white people do live in racial segregation. We live the most segregated lives. It is not segregation that just happens, although we like to describe it that way, right? It is the result of decades of policies and practices, de jure in the past, de facto today. And I always like to offer, you know, what does it mean to be told that everybody's equal while we live separately, right? Is that really what we're teaching, right? And millennials, I am doing a lot of contracting with, you know, large tech companies. When I walk around and think to myself, I guess you have to be under 30 to work here. I see the result of that generation of colorblindness, right? And they are incapable of thinking critically about race, and they find themselves, as the caller just described, shocked, like, I had no idea. But that lack of knowing is not benign, right? We bring that to the table with us, and the few people of color, and I should say in particular the few African American people in their workplace, are in a lot of pain. Because if I cannot think critically about how my own race has shaped my life, I'm not going to be able to hold or receive information about how your race shapes yours, right? I'm not going to probably be very good at bearing witness to an alternative experience. And the people of color that work with us day in and day out know that we can't answer that question. You know, what does it mean to be white? And they have to navigate that. It's subtle, quote unquote, to us. It's not subtle at all to them.
Robin DiAngelo is with us. If you've just joined the conversation, we're talking with her about her book, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. Soliciting your opinion on this, and I started the show saying, indeed, this will be an uncomfortable discussion to join and to follow and to listen to. It's a candid, constructive discussion about how to accept a truth, the one that Robin and I are talking about, which is that we all carry racialized assumptions and beliefs, and then to meet that head on, to really understand what it means to have a dominant white identity. I invite you into the discussion. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Robin, I was having a conversation about white supremacy with a friend yesterday, And we were talking about how when you use that, not you, when we use that phrase, when we think of white supremacy, a pretty vivid image, I'd say, of something like Charlottesville, Virginia, and the neo-Nazis that marched down there comes to mind. And so I think that permits us to say, well, I'm not that. And so I'm nowhere in this discussion about white supremacy. Will you reset our expectation on what that is?
Sure. You know, yes, the term includes those people who march, you know, the classic image, the traditional image. And it is also a highly descriptive sociological term for the culture we live in, a culture in which white people are held up as the norm for humanity, as the universal human being, and everyone else is a particular kind of human being and a, you know, deficit deviation from that universal white norm. Again, it's a highly descriptive term, and listeners who have a strong reaction to it, I would say, are going to have to evolve a little bit and move forward, because those of us who are active in this work, you are using it more and more precisely because it does describe the culture so well.
This friend of mine does some diversity training in the arts, and she was telling me that when groups gather together, she still finds this, even I guess in the arts community, she still finds this thing where individuals in the discussion will stand up and proclaim, you know, kind of declare who they are and what they are when it comes to race. And that is expected to kind of set, as you just said, that's expected to be the standard. That's the, I'm setting the tone for the conversation about race that follows here. She finds that often shuts the discussion down, and I guess intimidates some people from really entering this without all the answers.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really great image of the lack of humility, that we're so certain, and there's so much arrogance in that certainty, right? And, you know, in many, many ways, I have not been taught to value the voices of people of color. If the average white person asks themselves, when's the first time you had a teacher of a different race from yourself? And how often did that happen? Mm-hmm. Many of us never, and, you know, occasionally, right? So, and that's just one arena in which all of the voices of authority are white over and over and over. And so when that person stands up, they're also making a claim, kind of a subtext is, and there's nothing of value for me to learn from the voices or experiences of the people of color who may share here today, because my learning is finished.
Mary says on Twitter, thank you for this. As a black mid-30s female who's always lived in majority white communities, I've struggled with finding friends who understand my experience. It's isolating and feels like gaslighting when people insist a racist experience must have been anything but racism. You know, Robin, I'd read your book and I was listening to a This American Life about the training that went on at Starbucks in the wake of that incident in Philadelphia. And Mary is relating something that happened in some of that training, where the discussion with some of the best intentions ended up being, I don't know if that was really racist. Are you sure you're interpreting that right? How do you get on, how do you get to underneath that when you're doing this kind of work?
Yeah, there's a couple of premises you need to begin with, and that is, as a white person in this culture, I am the least qualified to determine whether something is racist or not, right? You know, my not seeing it is not really relational to its reality. And that willingness to believe, to listen, to consider, to have some curiosity, and you know, why would I understand it? I mean, it's come from me, not at me, if you will. And there's another point I want to make. to your earlier comment, yes, we all carry racial bias, but when you take a group's collective bias and you back it with legal authority and institutional control, it is transformed into a far-reaching system. So I do reserve the word racism to describe that system, mm-hmm. and I don't say that everybody's racist. Again, I say everybody has racial bias, but the impact of my bias is profoundly different because, again, it's backed with the weight of history and institutions.
I want to make sure we didn't miss what you just said. You're careful about using the word racist. You want people to understand we all carry what I was calling racial assumptions. You were saying saying racial bias. And you're saying, except that I enter into an acknowledgement of this with all the, I think you said, weight and power of history and supremacy behind me. Yes. Do I have that right?
Yes. And current institutions. There are a lot of challenges to talking to white people about racism. And one is that we don't appear to understand socialization. Mm-hmm. So we think that we can be exempt from the forces of culture, the forces of the society we live in. Another challenge is we don't understand what racism is. So post-civil rights, it made a pretty brilliant adaptation. It got reduced to this incredibly simplistic formula, right? A racist is an individual, mm-hmm. right? Always just an individual, not a system, mm-hmm. Who consciously does not like people based on race, so it must be conscious, and intentionally seeks to be mean. Must be intentional. And by that definition, virtually all white people are exempt from the society we live in, right? And that
That's
definition...
convenient.
Well, it guarantees defensiveness. It guarantees that you basically are going to hear me say, if I suggest you're complicit in this system, you're going to hear that I have just questioned your moral character.
Right.
And so now you're going to have to defend your moral character. And so that is just a key piece of the struggle of trying to talk to white people about racism.
To Natalie in Brooklyn Park. Hi, Natalie. So glad
good
you
morning.
Heard the show. Come on. Good morning.
Oh, this
Come
has
on
been
in.
Amazing. When I heard that this was happening, I had to stay tuned in.
Good.
Yeah, thank you for having this conversation. And Robin, I just had to comment about your statement and acknowledgement, as I am a middle-aged black woman here in the Twin Cities, raised in New York. I just had to acknowledge and thank you for acknowledging our pain. When you spoke about the young woman who just had no idea that there was a difference, really, between, you know, amongst people of color versus those who are white,
mm-hmm.
It brought back to me a conversation I had with a couple of my friends who are in Wisconsin. They're white, you know, they're wonderful, wonderful women. And we're having conversation about race, and they said, well, we're colorblind. I don't notice color, and I almost lost it, and they didn't understand why. And I had to explain that when they assume color blindness, it negates all of the experiences I've had, the racist experience, the harassment, the being followed around the store, mm-hmm. you know, the kids throwing stones, the nasty names, all of those things I grew up with. And a light bulb went off. But, you know, it's a constant conversation, and it's not just with friends. It's with just people you're around all the time, because their perspective and their lens is very, simplistic, very simplistic.
So, Natalie, when you say a light bulb went off, I think what happened there with you is one of the discussions that a lot of people would say, you know, just hearing about it, oh, I don't know, so touchy. And yet, what I think I hear you saying is something meaningful really happened there.
Yes,
and I would
agree.
Yeah.
Sorry, and I think it really had to do with trust. You know, we as friends, we trust each other in being able to be honest mm-hmm. and, you know, have a true, deep down, uncomfortable conversation and accept each other's perspective. And that's what I think made the difference.
Glad you called. Robin?
Yeah, and I mean, I hope your friends understood the risk that it took in that moment for you to challenge that, right, by yourself with more than one white person, right? That, you know, essentially we put you in the position to have to push and educate, and you know, you chose to do so, and it was a rewarding experience for you, but it could easily not have been, right? It could easily have gone the other direction and left you very isolated and you know, a bit wounded. The thing I want to say about colorblindness, I wish white people understood, one, that indicates that you are not particularly self-aware. And I often kind of say facetiously, when people of color hear us say that, you know, we don't see race or we were taught to treat everyone the same, they're generally not thinking, all right, I am talking to a woke white person right now. Right? I mean, generally some version of eye rolling is going on. Here we go. A wall maybe is coming up. And a dear friend of mine, Erin Trent Johnson, who's a black woman who is a trainer in this area, says, you know, that is a dangerous white person to me. I just wish white people understood that the evidence we give for our lack of racism is not good evidence, and it's not convincing.
Dangerous, Robin, because that's somebody who thinks they have an open mind, but yes. They don't. They don't know what they don't know. Is that the deal?
And is very unaware, and probably fairly certain, and so therefore not open.
Adam says on Twitter, privileged waking white guy here. I'm in the middle of Robin's powerful new book, and it is both eye-opening and instructive. He says the stats on page 31 are profound, wondering what's the most powerful question we should be asking ourselves and the systems we control. I have the book. I have this page marked. I think he's asking you about the stats on the 10 richest Americans, U.S. Congress, all those numbers about being white. So he's asking, what are some of the questions we should ask about that?
Well, first of all, I love that question. I don't usually get a question that helpful in a way to guide me to kind of make a point I'd like to make.
Good.
The question we should be asking ourselves is, the forces of race in this country, the forces of racism have shaped me. It is inevitable that they have shaped me. And so it's on me to figure out how and what that looks like in my daily life, not if, right? And if we start from the premise, and you know, I'm just going to put it out bluntly, as a white person who grew up in this country, as a result of that, I have a racist worldview. I have developed racist patterns, and I have investments in the system of racism, which is so comfortable and has served me so well. In fact, helped me overcome other barriers I have faced. And I also have investments in not really seeing that for what it would require of me in terms of action and for how it challenges my identity, right? I didn't want it. I didn't choose it, but I have it. And it's actually incredibly liberating and transformative to begin from that premise and then, you know, set forth to figure out how it manifests in my life. But again, not if. But the current paradigm would not allow for that.
I like what you're saying about it being liberating. It's freeing to say, I didn't set this up. I don't necessarily buy into it, but here it is. Now what? Yeah?
Yes. Yes.
Here's some of the numbers that Adam was referring to that Robin puts in the book. 10 richest Americans, 100% white. U.S. Congress, 90% white. People who decide which books we read, 90% white. People who decide which news is covered, 85% white. Some of the statistics that appear in Robin DiAngelo's new book called White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. I know a lot of you wanting to get in on the discussion. We'll get a look at the latest news when we come back, taking your calls and your questions and hearing Robin's insight on this. You can reach me on Twitter if you're getting a busy signal on the phone lines, @Kerri, KerriMPR. Back to the discussion now with Robin DiAngelo about her new book, White Fragility. And I want to say something here. I think given the fact that we had some discussion about millennials and this idea, Robin, that they were raised with this kind of colorblind standard, right, or ideal, I really would like to hear from some millennials about your experience maybe being raised with that in your household and then your experience in the wider world, white and millennials of color. So if you're listening this morning, let's just say you're 35 and under. I want to hear how you're hearing this conversation. Let me throw the number out, 651-227-6000. And Robin, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, I just had a follow-up thought on that question of that the previous person asked on Twitter, right? Like, I would never be marching in Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. I would be protesting marching on Charlottesville. But I know, and I share many examples in the book, I know that I have perpetrated harm on people of color unintentionally and unawarely, right? It's not benign just because it's unintentional and unaware, right? And so, again, I just want to repeat this question that I really offer white listeners is, what does it look like in my life? Right. And that's not an easy question. It's going to take, you know, effort and education and, you know, engaging in questions across race. But again, it is coming out. Right. Your Natalie, right, shared the frustration, you know, and those are her beloved friends who, you know, clearly love her and she has a relationship with. But, you know, they were moving through the world with this colorblind ideology, which wasn't helpful to her.
Right? Which felt good to them, right? It does feel good. It feels righteous to be able to say, it reminds me of that Stephen Colbert skit. Do you remember that? Where he'd say, I don't see color. And it was funny because we knew how ridiculous it was.
Yeah. And sometimes you have to step back and watch somebody else step in it. And then you can see.
Right.
I mean, I take a lot of these narratives in my presentations and I just show how actually as silly they are. And, you know, and most of the people in the audience are like, oh, my God, I just said that 3 days ago. But if you can laugh at it, then you can laugh at yourself a little bit and maybe kind of get out some of that tension and anxiety.
Call here from Sarah in Minneapolis. Hey, Sarah, hi.
Oh, hi. Okay, hi. My question has to do with schools. I'm a white family, 4 kids. We go through Minneapolis public schools and live in Northeast Minneapolis.
Uh-huh.
And I want to know how to talk to my white neighbors, because there's a lot of white people around me, very comfortable, about sending your kids to your community schools, which have free and reduced lunch rates of, you know, 40, 50 is getting higher as you go to high school, 70 and 81%. And why that isn't valued, why can't we value that as an education and white flight, people leaving? And honestly, it's very emotionally charged for me.
Yeah. No, that's understandable. You know, I think using your own experience, right, just sharing with them how important it's been for you, how rewarding it's been, what you insight you've gained as a result of having your kids go to these schools, you know, kind of try to point the finger inward rather than outward. It's hard to argue with your insights and your experiences. It doesn't mean people won't, but it's easier for them to take that in than if you point your finger out, like, why are you not going to these local schools? And but it is a self-fulfilling kind of loop, right? So we don't put our efforts and our tax bases in the local schools, and then we critique the local schools for, you know, being underfunded, etc. So there's a lot of good information out there around children and talking to children, which I would assume you know about, but I would direct listeners to that information. And probably the last thing I would say about children is it's like the analogy of being on the airplane. You need to put your oxygen mask on first and then turn to the more vulnerable. And I thought the caller was going to ask, how do I talk to my children, right? And you didn't. So, but a lot of white parents will ask that question. And I guess I would start by asking, how would I talk to you, right? Are you able to engage critically on questions of race and racism and how it shaped your life? And if you can't do that, you're not going to be effective at guiding your children in it.
Call here from Maura in Minneapolis. Hi, Maura.
Thank you so much. It's Moira.
Sorry about that.
Thank you so much for taking my call. And thank you so much for this conversation. I'm really happy to hear it.
Glad you heard it.
I'm calling, and I think it's somewhat pertinent, because right now, starting today, Convergence, which is the largest science fiction, fantasy, and popular culture convention in Minneapolis, is starting. I'm a professional woman. I'm a woman of color. I'm Irish, Filipino, and Polynesian.
Uh-huh.
I'm a professional writer and illustrator. And when I first moved here from southern Michigan, I met a lot of white women, liberals, who are science fiction and speculative fiction writers. And very often in those conversations, I would bring up the fact that Minneapolis was so much more racist from the southern Michigan area that I moved from.
Bet that made people feel uncomfortable,
well,
yes?
I the amount of eye rolling and head shaking and, you know, eye exchanges and glances for each other was just phenomenal to me. And I thought, you're supposed to be progressive liberal women. What's with this? I have experienced this. I am shocked by it. I haven't seen this kind of stuff since the 70s. But the conversation, there wouldn't be a conversation. Well, what happened in the science fiction writing community is diversity, in quotes, became a thing.
Hmm.
And we wanted to have more people of color who were writers and more books written by people of color about characters of color. And suddenly they became bestsellers, and authors became Hugo and Nebula Award winners like N.K. Jemisin.
Yeah.
And all these women, many of whom, you know, are mid-listers or tiny press people, would suddenly become social justice warriors. And their Twitter feeds would be filled with all this righteous indignation of how white people were treating people of color. And whenever black women writers would show up at conventions, these women would storm and they'd follow them around like little ducklings and try to bask in their glory, because that was one thing that they couldn't, one bandwagon they couldn't jump on.
Yeah.
They couldn't suddenly become people of color. And I see this, I'm no longer in communication with these people, but I'd watch this from afar and think, you know, being brown and black and people of color, that's not a marketing trend. You know, so the idea that you are somehow going to latch onto the coattails of someone else's life experience so you can get a better agent, so you can get a better publisher, or you can get a better panel at the convention is extremely offensive to me.
Maura, can I just ask you this, because we're talking about literature here. How do you feel about the We Need Diverse Books movement, which I support, you know, a lot of white readers support and want to support, but do you feel like you're coming late to the game here? Don't kid yourself.
Well, are you talking about writers of color coming late to the game?
No.
Or white
readers, right? Yeah.
Readers. Well, as someone who grew up never seeing anyone like myself in children's literature,
yeah,
ever,
yeah,
I am all for this. Now, it gets complicated because what started to happen is you had already established white authors who decided the thing to do now was to make their main character of color. There's a lot of local authors who've done that. My specialty is graphic novels. A lot of graphic novelists, whose work I absolutely love, started doing characters of color. A perfect example is, I'll try to be quick, I know you've got a lot of people waiting, Ghosts by Raina Telemeiser. I apologize for not pronouncing her last name correctly. I love her work. She did Smiles, she did Sisters and Drama. But Ghosts had a mixed-race character who discovers her Latinx background,
mm-hmm,
and she completely misrepresented the Day of the Dead. And it was people who, that is their culture, they spoke out against the book,
mm-hmm,
but it wasn't listened to because she's a best-selling author.
Mm.
So I'm for We Need Diverse Books mostly when it is people of color who are writing about characters of color and their experience, because that's authentic and it's also extremely underrepresented.
We could talk about this for an hour, Moira. But I'm really interested in how Robin is hearing what you said.
Well, I have two thoughts. And one is just, I hope your white listeners are paying attention, right? Because the callers, the people of color who have called in are describing what it looks like from white progressives, right? The frustrations and daily indignities they endure from us, right? So really, don't want your listeners to distance themselves. And then I want to make a comment about white women.
Yeah.
We do not land any more lightly on people of color. And that's another theme I'm hearing, right? And, there is not a universal, sisterhood that my experience of being a woman in this culture cannot be separated from the reality that I'm also a white woman. And when white women do not back people of color in significant ways, and not in the ways that, Moira just described, right, co-opting, adding a character and coloring her brown, when we don't back people of color, I think the hurt and the betrayal is potentially even deeper, because we have a potential way in through understanding sexism, but so many white women use it as a way out.
Uh-huh. A listener says on Twitter, white male millennial here. My parents' generation were colorblind. My journey to moving beyond that began when I told someone I was scared that I would be shot by police after Philando Castile. That person told me this wouldn't happen to you and got me curious. And to Butch in Brainerd. Hi, Butch. Thanks so much for waiting.
No problem.
What are you thinking about as you listen to this?
I'm thinking about you're telling one side of the story. I'm 70-some years old. I've driven across the United States for 50 years, been everywhere there was to be with a truck and even as a tourist, and I experienced racism from the other side. Maybe it's a preconceived notion when they see me, a white man, that I'm going to act a certain way from what they've experienced before, what they've been told, but nobody ever talks about that. I go places and I go wherever I want to go, and I don't care what the area, the neighborhood, the bar, restaurant, anything, and I'm treated different because I'm white.
You're saying that doesn't happen to you, or it happens to you in a way that you think assumptions are being made?
Uh-huh. Like people treat me different because I'm a white man.
Butch, I appreciate the call. Robin, I suspect that there are, a number of people listening who are raising similar questions.
Well, it goes back to everyone has racial bias, and a black person can be biased against me, doesn't even know me, dismisses me out of hand because I'm white. But when you back that collective bias, let's go back to those statistics you read, right? When you have a particular group who controls all the institutions, the impact of that is transformed, and where I can move through my daily life and avoid having to encounter people who may make those kinds of assumptions about me. People of color cannot avoid interacting with me. And if there's a grievance between us, going up the chain of who would hear that grievance, almost everyone is going to represent me and reflect my point of view. Mm-hmm. So I am not saying people of color are not racially biased, but I think it's really critical that we reserve some language to talk about that difference. And the example I often give is women's suffrage. So women were granted the right to vote in this country in 1920, and there was only one possible way that we could get it, and that was for men to give it to us. I could have personal power. I could be mean to a man one-on-one, if it's 1918 and I'm a pissed-off suffragette. But my group could not literally deny his entire group their civil rights. But his group could and did deny my entire group my civil rights. That difference is really profound. And when we use these terms interchangeably, like, it's all the same, we take that off the table. And let me just add one more piece. Of course, white men granted white women full access to the right to vote.
Will you also tell the Jackie Robinson example that you use in the, maybe this will break through, you know, as a story here that we are all familiar with in a way that some of our other conversation won't?
Yeah, I'd love to tell that. You know, it is critical that we understand our history, and we're really not taught our history. So this is another challenge of talking to white people about racism. We don't know our history, and we can't trace it into the present. You know, we think that, apparently a lot of white people think that racism ended when slavery ended. So I use the example of the Jackie Robinson story to make several points, one of which is who tells the story and the impact of how we tell the story. So Jackie Robinson is famous for, you know, the tagline is breaking the color line, right?
Right.
And every anniversary of that event, we celebrate Jackie Robinson. And so when we think about the way we tell that story, he did it. He broke the color line. The subtext is he was exceptional. He was racially special. He was an exception to his group. So subtext, most of his group was inferior. But finally, he had what it took to break through and play with us, right? Now, imagine if we told a story like this. Jackie Robinson, the first black man that whites allowed to play Major League Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really didn't matter how exceptional he was. I'm sure he was an exceptional ball player. I doubt he was the first and most exceptional black ball player ever. But no matter how exceptional he was, if we didn't say he could play Major League Baseball, he couldn't play. It wasn't up to him. And if he walked out on the field before we said you can play, the police would have removed him. And the reason I think it's really important that we tell the story the second way is, one, it's the truth. But also, I'm not interested in pointing out how bad white people are, but I do need role models. You know, what were the strategies people used behind the scenes? Clearly that, you know, white people ultimately made that happen. And how might we use those strategies today? Because another problematic assumption that the way we currently tell the story reinforces is that racism in sports ended when Jackie Robinson broke the color line. And I think we should be pretty clear. It did not.
It's an acknowledgement of where all the power still resided, right?
Yes.
In the white infrastructure. Here's Meredith. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Robin.
Oh, go ahead. I just want to reiterate it. So your caller, Butch, I'm sure that he experiences racial prejudice from people of color. But I, again, don't call that racism.
Meredith says, I'm a millennial white woman, first heard about white privilege in college, then got great development about anti-racist work as a teacher. This is essential for the next generation. Colleges need to be in the work. Gretchen says, this program rocks. I'm 66 and white. Especially appreciate greater use of white supremacist as a descriptor, as well as racist. And to the phones here to Jordan in St. Cloud. Hi, Jordan.
Hi.
Hi. Glad you called. You're in your mid-20s, yes?
Yeah, actually late 20s.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm a white male. And, you know, I really do appreciate this program because I'm actually having some issues with family members. So in college, I kind of figured out, you know, I always said I was colorblind. I kind of learned that that's not a real thing. It's not an acceptable thing. People's backgrounds shape who they are, and ignoring all of those bias, be it gender or race or whatever, it really does shape people. But I'm now having issues with family members who believe that white privilege and you know, systemic racism is a myth or a farce or even a joke at times. And I was wondering what steps we could take to kind of, you know, bring these people to and a better understanding of this problem.
Good. I have about a minute and a half there, Robin, if you will.
Well, there's a few just really quick strategies. First, let me acknowledge family has got to be the most challenging, certainly for me. So one, I choose my moments because I know my family really well and I know when they're open. Two, I think it's okay to return to something, right? Hey, you know, I've been thinking about that conversation we had last week, and something about it just has been bothering me. I've had trouble putting my finger on it, but I think I have more clarity. Would you be open to revisiting that, right? That kind of approach. Also, again, trying to point the finger inward, right? Well, you know, I understand that way of seeing it. I certainly have seen it that way. But based on my work and based on the opportunity I've had lately to hear from people of color and their perspectives, I've come to realize. And you just kind of chip away. It's a little bit like water dripping on a rock, right? Even for myself.
Robin,
I didn't get this the first time I heard it.
Robin, thank you so much for the hour.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Robin DiAngelo's book is called White Fragility.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.